Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 596 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writer Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What have you been up to this week? I had a very lovely Easter, kind of just pottering around. I did manage to schedule in some relaxation time. You know, I read books, I had a few social events, all in all a wonderful few days. I did do one intense day of working, actually, on Easter Saturday, and that day was dedicated to doing all the things that I have been putting off. You know, those things that you know are really important, but for whatever reason you just procrastinate and procrastinate, or rather you procrasti-clean, or procrasti-watch TV, or procrasti-declutter, or procrasti-walk the dog, whatever, right? You literally do everything except everything else except for the thing you're meant to do. And, you know, before long, it's 5 months later and you still haven't done all the things. Now, if it's not because you're lazy, for me, it's because usually in this kind of situation, there's some kind of block. You know, it might be a mindset shift that needs to happen, or it might be some emotional block, or it might be because it's associated with putting yourself out there in some way, and maybe you're insecure about the reasons for doing the thing. Or it could be all of the above. I don't know if you relate to any of this. So anyway, I was talking to a friend of mine who is going through the exact same thing. She's a creative as well, and she has a bunch of tasks on her to-do list. And I mean, in general, she is a go-getter, but when it comes to these particular tasks, she knows that she also has a block on those. So we decided to keep each other accountable on a kind of like a no excuses kind of day, you know, where we didn't analyze why we're procrastinating on these particular activities, and the aim was to just get them done. And anyway, this was inspired by my friend Michelle Barraclough, who is also one of our wonderful presenters here at the Australian Writers' Centre. She knew that she had to make a real dent in her manuscript, so she took herself off to a writing retreat for a few days and she smashed out a ton of words. Now, I couldn't be bothered travelling somewhere for a writing retreat, so my friend and I booked a local co-working space for the day. And we picked a nice one so that we were in a good environment, and we wrote out a list of things that we needed to get done, and the ones that, you know, we've been procrastinating over for a long time, and estimated how much time each task or each project would take, and then blocked them into that no excuses day. And if we got everything done, we would take ourselves off to dinner that evening. And that's exactly what we did. It was very effective because we set our intentions for the day on a spreadsheet beforehand and we were accountable to each other. It also then meant that I could relax the rest of the Easter weekend because I felt that I had achieved a lot on that day. Another big Easter event I want to remind you about though, just come to think of it, is our amazing Easter sale is on. The Easter sale is where you get $50 off a huge range of courses. And if you haven't yet taken up this offer, you have until midnight Thursday, the 4th of April to do that. You can check it all out at writerscentre.com.au/sale. There are about 40 courses on sale and I couldn't possibly mention them all now, but you might want to check out the incredible Fiction Essentials series of courses. These are self-paced so that you can do them in your own time, and there will definitely be one there to help you on whatever you may need a bit of guidance on. You know, there's Fiction Essentials Dialogue if you struggle with dialogue or if you want to make your dialogue sound more authentic. There's Fiction Essentials Scenes so that you'll understand how to write a tight scene that just engages readers. You know, you'll know when to come in on a scene, when to leave a scene. Fiction Essentials Grammar and Punctuation is essential if you're not quite sure if your grammar and punctuation is up to scratch. But, you know, you need to make sure that you're getting things right in your manuscript. And a real cracker, game changer, is Fiction Essentials Point of View. So many people don't quite get how to write in the right point of view. So this will break it down so that you understand point of view forever. So there are many other courses on sale as well, where you get $50 off around 40 courses. Again, this is only until Thursday, the 4th of April, and it's our Easter sale. So check out writercentre.com.au/sale. And now let's welcome back Nat Newman, who is going to be sharing her writing tip with us this week. Now, Nat, last week, my rapid fire kind of, I learned a lot about you through my rapid fire, so I'm going to repeat it.
Oh, okay.
Yes. What is the next play you're going to see?
The next play I'm going to see? That's a great question.
If you have one. If you haven't booked one, then tell me your last play that you saw.
Okay, the last play I saw was called Dangerous Obsession at the Maitland Repertory Club. That was great. One of my friends was appearing in it, and it was fabulous. It's just a three-hander, very, very tense. I was literally on the edge of my seat the entire time, and a couple times I had to put my hands over my eyes and even gasped. So that's what you want from theatre. Yeah.
Okay, what was the last movie you saw at the cinema?
Oh, at the cinema? I don't know. I think... It was either Dune 2 or Zone of Interest, one of those. Yeah.
Okay. Good, bad?
Amazing.
Oh, okay.
I love Denis Villeneuve. Sorry. He's French. It's not Denis Villeneuve. It's Denis Villeneuve. I think he's phenomenal. He can kind of do no wrong in my eyes.
I remember going to see the original Dune, not Dune 1 with – you know, Timothy
David
Chalamet,
Lynch?
But yes, with Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah.
Back in, I don't know, the early 80s or something. And it was so dark, like as in, and not metaphorically, I mean, not figuratively, but actually visually dark. I didn't know what was going on. And I actually walked out of the theatre.
Really?
Before it was finished because I was so bored.
I've heard it's a really, really tough film. I think that was the first time. Was that the first time David Lynch and Kyle MacLachlan worked together?
Possibly.
Yeah. I was listening to a great podcast with Kyle MacLachlan a little while ago, and he was talking about his experience with David Lynch and just how they work together. It's always interesting to me how actors and directors work together.
Yeah, and then you become a favourite of some director and then you get cast for the rest of your life, which is fabulous.
Yep.
okay, piece of music that you love.
Well, I'm just a big fan of Tool in
of
general.
What?
Tool, it's my favourite band. They're an American sometimes they're called heavy metal, sometimes they're called progressive rock. Yeah, but they have this one of their tracks that they reimagined for a later album, the name of which escapes me. But the track itself is called Push It. And I used to force people to, if they, you know, came over to visit my house or whatever, like, you know, we'd all go back to my place for beers. And I would force people to lie on the lounge room floor and I would I would put that song on and turn the bass right up and force them to listen to all 12 minutes of it. And
I never would have picked you as a heavy metal person.
Oh yeah, Rage Against the
I
Machine.
Wish I knew
really
that.
Old school though. Yeah.
I wish I knew that because was it last year? It was certainly before COVID and then no one would go with me. And then after COVID, still no one would go with me. It was that heavy metal festival. Not that I'm into heavy metal, but I'm obsessed with My Chemical Romance and they were headlining.
Oh, amazing.
And I wish I knew that because well, maybe you wouldn't have gone with me either.
Oh, we might have, you never know. No, I seriously like
that doesn't sound very committal.
Like I think it was my Europe trip 2 years ago. I literally planned it around the fact that Rage Against the Machine were gonna be playing in Zagreb. And as you know, I used to live in Zagreb. And I thought, oh fantastic, I'll go watch Rage Against the Machine in Zagreb, and booked my whole it's not the only reason I was going to Europe, but I have lots of friends there and stuff, and you know, kind of booked this whole trip, and then they cancelled because I had injuries. I was like, oh, god damn it. Anyway, but I went to see Tool in Prague. Was that Prague I saw them, or Warsaw? Anyway, can't remember. And a couple of times in Australia as well. And yeah.
How fantastic to see, you know, some of your to see your favorite band in all different parts of the world. I'd love to do that with the Killers. But anyway, let's move on. What's your writing tip this week?
Yeah, so this is something I think that comes up with a lot of newer writers. I hear people, you probably hear this too, who say, I don't like writing in first person. Or I feel like when I'm writing in first person, it doesn't sound right. And they don't feel comfortable writing in first person. And normally when I have a read of what they've written, what I find is that some people, when they're writing in first person, they think that they can only write what the person is thinking. And they're so involved in the head of the character that they forget that the character has a body and that body is moving through space and time. And so when you're writing in first person, so for example, you might have someone who's at the supermarket and they're in the bread aisle, right? And so one thing you might do is you might sort of go, oh bother, they don't have any muffins. I really like the muffins, and you might just think about their thought process, and that's great. But a stronger way to approach is to actually have them, I reach for the muffin tray, and but it's empty. You know, they're using their body to investigate the space around them. I turn around, but there's also nothing on the shelf next to me, for example. So if you're finding that you're struggling with first person, have a look.
Well, I turn around and I run my hands along the steel middle of the yep. shelves.
Yeah. And I can smell that that they've just finished baking some croissants. My Harry loves croissants. Maybe I'll pick some of those up later. So you definitely need thoughts, but you have to balance it with physical action. So if you feel like your first person point of view is not working, have a look and see, is your character only having thoughts, or do they actually have a physical body? This is something I tell my students all the time. A lot of writing is physics. Your characters move through time and space. So just have a think about, is your character actually moving through time and space, or are they only existing in their head? And that could be a really big clue as to why your first person point of view isn't working.
It's a good exercise. You know, just write 500 words in one way and write 500 words being really aware of everything that you've just said. And sometimes write first person without ever using the word I and see what happens. It's, you know, probably just a good exercise.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing your writing tip with us this week, Nat. Have a great
week. Thank you, Valerie. You too. Bye.
I'm going to move on to our competition this week. I have three copies of Anna O by Matthew Blake to give away. Anna O is a compelling and unsettling crime story that will have you hooked until the wee hours of the morning. Here's the blurb. Joining the ranks of Gillian Flynn, AJ Finn, and Alex Michaelides, Matthew Blake delivers the thriller of the year, a dark, twisty, and shocking mystery about a young woman who commits a double murder while sleepwalking and then never opens her eyes again. Anna O will wake up the world. What if your nightmares weren't really nightmares at all? We spend an average of 33 years of our lives asleep, but what really happens, and what are we capable of when we sleep? Anna Ogilvy was a budding 25-year-old writer with a bright future. Then one night she stabbed two people to death with no apparent motive and hasn't woken up since. Dubbed Sleeping Beauty by the tabloids, Anna's condition is a rare psychosomatic disorder known to neurologists as resignation syndrome. Dr. Benedict Prince is a forensic psychologist and an expert in the field of sleep-related homicides. His methods are the last hope of solving the infamous Anna O case and waking Anna up so she can stand trial. But he must be careful treating such a high-profile suspect. He's got career secrets and a complicated personal life of his own. As Anna shows the first signs of stirring, Benedict must determine what really happened and whether Anna should be held responsible for her crimes. Only Anna knows the truth about that night, but only Benedict knows how to discover it, and they're both in danger from what they find out. If you'd like to win a copy, simply enter your details in the form at writercentre.com.au/win. It's very easy for you to enter, writercentre.com.au/win. Entries close on Monday, the 8th of April. And if you're at that URL in the future, don't worry, there'll be some other fantastic competition for you to enter. And now, are you ready for the word of the week? The word of the week this week is lassitude. Lassitude, that's L-A-S-S-I-T-U-D-E, lassitude. It sounds like it has something to do with attitude or altitude or sailing a boat maybe, but actually lassitude is a noun meaning weariness of body or mind from strain, oppressive climate, and so on. So you can use it as a synonym pretty well anywhere you might use weariness or fatigue. For example, the film captures the lassitude of a long summer vacation. There you go, lassitude. And that was the word of the week.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our course, Creative Nonfiction, is your essential guide to crafting a true story into a compelling, page-turning book. Creative nonfiction is one of the most popular genres in publishing right now, and it's clear to see why. People love a good story, and if it's based on true events, they're even more invested in it. Perhaps you want to explore true crime, history, or literary journalism. Maybe you have a great idea for a memoir or armchair travel book. It doesn't matter what subject you're passionate about, this course provides you with a blueprint on everything you need to know, from how to structure your story and bring its real characters to life, to the kind of research you need to do and the techniques that will drive your narrative to a powerful climax. With over 10 hours of lessons and plenty of practical exercises to complete, you'll discover how to weave your true story into a truly great read. This powerful course removes the guesswork and breaks down the process step by step so you can approach your writing project with confidence. And because it's one of our online self-paced courses, you can learn in your own time with 12 months access to all course materials. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/creativenonfiction. That's writerscentre.com.au/creativenonfiction.
Now let's move on to our writer in residence this week. Harry Sun's first book, a memoir called Private Equity, has been named a most anticipated book of 2024 by Oprah Daily, NPR, Town and Country, The Millions, Financial Times, and more. It's about her time as an assistant to the billionaire founder of a top Wall Street investment firm and is a gripping account of self-discovery, privilege, wealth, work culture, transformation, and reinvention. And I couldn't put it down. Thanks so much for joining us today, Carrie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're talking to us from New Jersey in the States, and you've just written this incredible memoir, Private Equity, which I absolutely loved. I inhaled it. For those people who have not yet read it, can you tell us what it's about?
Yes. The memoir is set in New York City, and it's about a time in my life when I'm 29 and I moved from Mid-Michigan to New York City to take on this job working as the right-hand person to this hedge fund billionaire. And really, it is a story of personal transformation and self-discovery set at work. It is how I come to discover not only who I am, but what I want my life to be. I think it is also a cautionary tale about work itself. I think it's raising questions about how we work in, certainly in America, but I think this style of American work of just hyper efficiency and always on 24/7 work culture, I think that has been unfortunately spreading across the world. And in my book, I am asking if this is the way we want to live and work. And could there be another way to go about life?
I love this book, not only because it explores those themes, not only because it's very well written, but I mean, voyeuristically, it is a peek into a world that most of us do not get to peek into. Because when you say that you were the right-hand person, you really were the right-hand person. You were called an assistant, but you are beyond an assistant. I mean, the gamut of what you had to do was astounding to me. And the skills required was astounding to me. Because not only did you have to organize, say, special, you know, tables at lunches, you needed to understand human resources, politics, economics, how to translate, analyze, and research financial instruments. I mean, it is astounding what you needed to do. When you went into this job, did you know you had it was that breadth?
That is a great question. As I write in my book, I didn't receive a job description before I took this job. So that, you know, that gets into the cautionary tale aspect. Maybe have it written down before you know what you're signing up for. But I was told, you know, I would be managing this person's work life. And since work is pretty much all of his life, I managed all of his life. He had at one point called me an extension of his mind and eyes and ears. And so it's really just an extension of him. And I kind of managed, as you say, just so many things beyond what I would say a more typical assistant role would require, which is like calendar management, logistics, but I was also providing operational support, leverage, and also research and communications. I mean, it was all of it. It was all just any sort of information coming in and out of his office. It was through me. He wanted to have it all funneled through me. And as you were saying, it did require financial knowledge, both of what they were doing, but also instantaneously on the markets and news, because part of the job was just being able to triage everything that came in. And so to understand the level of importance of everything that was coming in and to be able to prioritize and have to do that instantaneously, you know, because things were coming at me so fast. Often I would have multiple people on the phone at the same time, talking to them, rotating like on holds, you know? And so, yeah, it was really, really challenging. I didn't really know what I was signing up for, but, how it pertains to your podcast. I wanted to be a writer, and I thought that I knew I needed a day job. And because I didn't come from money, I wanted to have a day job. And I know I was switching careers at that point, and I knew I didn't know how long it would take me to be a writer. And I wanted to be a writer, and I didn't want to put that money pressure on my writing. And I wanted to give myself the time to really develop my craft, because writing is a skill and a practice and habit. And I knew that I needed a day job. And so this was my choice of a day job to hopefully support my career change, because as I detail in the book, a recruiter reached out to me for this position. And that's the start of the book.
So the irony, of course, is you had no time left in your life
exactly.
for anything, let alone yes. writing, for any social life, or, you know, barely any social life, for dating, for anything, you had no time. And you do mention in the book that you were interested in writing from you know, a young age.
Yes.
When did you know you were interested in writing, or when did you know that you wanted to become a writer?
That is a wonderful question, because actually part of the, you know, as I mentioned, my book is a process of self-discovery. And so what I'm trying to dramatize on the page is really a changing consciousness. And so the person I am at the beginning is totally different from the person I am at the end. And there were so many just stories I was telling myself about my life at the beginning that just turned out to be maybe just not so true. And I needed to kind of unwind all those things. And one of them was, you know, I've actually wanted to be a writer all my life. And I think actually now I tell myself, you know, I can tell myself these stories about I went into finance because I wanted financial stability, which is just entirely true, because when my parents first immigrated from China to Michigan, we were struggling. They were graduate students, you know, paying out of state tuitions, often full tuitions while working multiple jobs of, you know, being a dishwasher or a maid or, you know, delivering pizza. So it was a real struggle for us. But I also really, you know, the other side is perhaps I just didn't have the courage to go all in on writing, because writing feels, you know, it just is. There's no sure thing, and you just have to keep on trying. And at that stage in my life, perhaps I wasn't there yet with my writing practice and just how I thought about my writing career. And I went into finance for that reason. But really, primarily, I think I also detail kind of a fairly traumatic childhood and certainly traumatic time at college. And so right after that, for all these reasons, I just wanted to have something stable. And that
But
meant a stable
where did
job.
the interest start? Where did the what was the thing that made you want to become interested in writing in the first place?
So both my parents were English professors in China in the 80s, and I think that is a large part of it. They were among the first college students in China after the Cultural Revolution. They majored in English, and both my parents really instilled a love of literature in me. My first photos I have of myself, they're of me like staring at the page, like writing. I'm like two or three, you know, I can't read then, but I think I'm reading because I'm probably following what my parents are doing, you know? And so, yes, exactly. And I think that love of reading, I just immersed myself in books. And then when we, immigrated to America, I was four. Then my parents, as I mentioned, were busy working and also going to school. I spent a lot of time by myself. And since we didn't really have money, I would just read anything that they had. So I was, you know, 6 years old, and I didn't understand this, but I was reading their like GRE books or like my dad's computer programming books, just anything we had lying around because, you know, we didn't have extra funds to buy books. And so I read those books. I just immersed myself in that. And of course my school had a school library and I would always carry the so many books with me back home. We also had school book fairs. I was really sad about them because we were never able to buy anything. But I love the stories. And then as I write in my book at the very end, I wrote my first novel when I was 8 years old. You know, I've been wanting to live that dream for a long time, but I put it aside and went
because
on
these
detours.
You know, wrote your first novel at eight. And then somewhere along the line, something obviously piqued your interest in the world of business, because you write how sort of in your teens you kind of overheard your parents talking about stocks and stuff like that. At the age of 17 you read Jim Collins' Good to Great. And then you and there's this cute scene where you wrote on a piece of paper or something, Sun, your last name, CEO.
Yes.
And decided, oh, my goal is to go to MIT or I might study business or whatever. So you get into that world. And I just want to also put this in context for listeners. And, you know, you got to go buy and read this book because it's so interesting. This world is so interesting and it is this incredible journey of understanding yourself and a journey of transformation. But for listeners, I want them to understand that Carrie, being this right-hand person, not only did so much incredible stuff, it's hard to pull yourself away because you are actually being paid extremely well.
Yes.
More than the Prime Minister of Australia, I looked up.
Okay.
So it's not like you weren't being compensated. So there's this push-pull because you think that you are being well compensated and you're in this incredible job. Now, the thing is, though, you've chosen to write a memoir. When you decided I'm going to write something, was it always going to be, that's it, I'm going to write a memoir? Or did you think, oh, should I be writing, you know, a work of fiction, or should I be writing short stories? Or how did you make that choice to write this?
I have always been really interested in both fiction and nonfiction. I would say I'm really interested in nonfiction that reads like a novel, you know, novelistic nonfiction, true stories that are compellingly told. And I also love the fiction side of that divide as well, where it's a lot of the novel is based in truth, but also you know, autofiction is a subgenre of that. But also, like, for example, I love this book, the novel When We Cease to Understand the World. And, you know, that's rooted in a lot of scientific fact, but just imagines a world and story out of that. And so it wasn't always clear to me what I would write about and how I would center the story. But during my MFA, which was during the years 2018 to 2020, I looked around and I just saw everybody, including myself, just burnt out. Like, everybody I knew was burned out, and they were working multiple jobs in New York to be able to support their creative writing and writing endeavors. And I just really thought that I had something to say about burnout and work itself. I had gone through this and I wanted to write about it. And I wanted to write about how I came to discover myself through work. So it's like a, you know, even though I'm 29 in the book, it's like a professional coming of age. And I also chose to center it on those 2 years, not really for any reason other than it was an extreme period of growth, and both like chaos and from the chaos comes growth for me. And to really understand how something happened, I really wanted to get into the nuances and the complexities. And it involves like breaking down relationships between me and my boss, me and my mother, father, me and my romantic partner, you know, and just to see how it really happened. And because actually the time I read it in the book, which is about two and a half years, it just everything happened so fast. I barely had time to breathe. I didn't have time to pee. And so,
yes, that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, after I quit, I really actually didn't know what had happened to me. It took me this entire time just to understand my own story from that time period, you know. So it's not like I quit and immediately wrote this book about like what it was like, because actually I couldn't answer the question what it was like. It took me years and years of both reflection and to incorporate that time period into my personal story to understand that I wanted to center it then. And the reason I wanted nonfiction versus fiction, because like I could tell the story as a novel, as you say, many people also call my book a novel actually, is that I love the genre creative nonfiction. And so if I can be in that space for this book, I really wanted to, because I there's something about the veracity of just the characters and like the story that makes it feel ring a little more it just true for me. And I wanted to express that to readers.
So when you choose to write a memoir, you do have to get really personal, because otherwise the reader isn't going to really be very happy because they've bought a memoir, right?
Yeah.
And you need to really, as you say, examine not only your relationships, but what's actually going on in your brain. Now, that can be very difficult to lay yourself out there, you know, and to lay out, you know, some of the things that happened to you that you accepted yes. happening to you, and admitting that you accepted that they happened to you. And, you know, there's lots of examples of that, but just to give readers a bit of an idea, for example, you talk about your ex-fiancé or your boyfriend, Josh, I'm sure that's not his name, who... And some of the things that he said to you and you thought were okay, or you didn't say anything back to him, is quite confronting. How does it feel to, how did you feel about laying all that on the page?
Yeah, great question, because, you know, so many people think writing a memoir is so cathartic. So it is, but also they think it's like somehow rewarding. And it's like, well, it's rewarding that I completed a book, but it was extremely emotionally difficult for much of it. Because as you say, my character at the beginning, like now, because I have gone through this personal growth, I am not the person I was then. So when I look at how I behaved then, it really has taken me all these years to be okay with that person and to actually look at that person with affection to be able to write. Because otherwise, I was judging that my former self so harshly, and I was feeling so ashamed that I didn't want to put the truth on the page, you know, because as you say, there are all these red flags, both from my ex fiance and certainly I think, like, you know, my parents were, they have, there's a lot of intergenerational trauma in this book. So I understand why they might have done what they did, but they were very hard on me at times as well. So was my boss in the book. And, you know, I just said, whatever. I just let the red flags fly all over the place and just ignored everything. And, you know, I, at first, when I started writing the book, felt very ashamed of that behavior, but it is truthful behavior. And I put it on the page because I actually have grown from it and learned from it. And that's where I hope to end up. I hope the character ends up at the end. And so that is the journey, but it was not easy. It was very much cringing at much of my own self, like previous self. But you know, that kind of naivete that one might approach a situation, or just a kind of willful ignorance of red flags. I think I am hoping that some readers might be able to identify with that and see that, you know, you can change and spot those early and actually learn something from it.
It's interesting you say the willful ignorance of the red flags, because obviously that does apply to Josh. But you write in the book when you know, at some point you made a decision that your mother wasn't happy with, and you said, "I shrugged off my mother's go-to line, 'You are no longer my daughter.' Being Chinese meant you never dwelled. Instead, you leaped forward." So you kind of just, I went, "Okay, you said this really horrendous thing to me, but I'm going to move forward."
Yes. It like you know, when I started therapy, as I did kind of detail at the end of this book, I would tell my therapist, like, my mother would say all these lines, and I would say them, and I would have no reaction. And that non-reaction was the information that I'm trying to show the reader, right? It's like I have intentionally put on the page that, you know, my mother says things like, you are no longer my daughter. And I'm just like, whatever, you know. And it's nothing to be proud of, but it was a learning experience for me.
I also love another reason I think listeners should read this book is there's just a subtlety in the way you tell your stories. You don't say, "And this is what you need to learn from it." You just end your chapter, you let it rest, and everyone can obviously draw their own conclusion, but I thought it was very clever the way you did that. Now, talk to me about, you decide, okay, I'm going to write the memoir. I like creative nonfiction. I'm going to write my memoir about these couple of years, intense years in my life. What did you do then for on a practical level? Did you just start writing, and or did you know it's going to follow this arc? You know, can you cast your mind back to when you first started writing the manuscript properly and what your plan was?
Yes. So I started writing the manuscript July 2020. I graduated from my MFA in May 2020, sold this book on proposal June 2020, and then started writing in earnest July 2020.
Okay, sold the book on proposal, but how much had you written? You must have written something to
Yes,
sell the book on proposal.
I wrote a I think it was 27,000 word book proposal, with I think two sample chapters. There are chapters one and two. along with the rest of, and it was 96 double space pages or something like that.
Okay. So then you got the yes from the publisher and you started writing. How long then did it take you to complete a manuscript?
I gave myself 1 month to outline. I ended up, the outlining process was so helpful to me because I was just trying to download everything that had happened and try to form and discover a natural narrative arc out of the material. So I spent 1 month just completely listing all my memories, going through all my text messages, all my emails. You know, as I mentioned in the book, I didn't really journal, but I have other notes. Like, for example, I would write down things I wanted to talk to my boss about, you know, like at our next meeting, you know, just, I have a ton of those documents. And so, personal documents. And so after that, I structure is something that is, I'm so interested in structure, and the structure came really just naturally to me one day, as in, like, I found the structure through the story. I think a character in my book, actually, really the lack of time and how we spend time and what time means and how much time we have at work versus our personal self. And so, you know, the structure of my book is completely actually based on time. It's like July 28th through August 18th. And then it's September 3rd, one day, you know, and then September 4th to September 30th. And the time structure and the way I structured the chapters, there are 13 chapters, they're all time-based, is in the beginning, the important, Valerie, it's so interesting that you mentioned my chapter ends, is because I think so much about chapter beginnings and ends, like when to start and stop, and, you know, it has to feel cohesive and whole. It suddenly came to me that the structure that I wanted the time to feel, the narrative of these two and a half years, is at the beginning, I was living my story. And so the chapter beginning and ends are important dates on my journey. That's why it's July 28th, the first day that the recruiter reached out to me. August 18th, the day I got the offer call from my boss, from my future boss. Then in the middle 50% of the book, I got lost in my work. And so the chapters are like first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. I wanted the monotony of that work experience and to just, like, I wanted the experience of the chapters to mirror losing myself in the narrative. And then so it becomes very just about work. And the chapter beginning and ends are defined by the financial calendar. So first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, you know, first quarter again, second quarter, third quarter. Then at the very end, I come out of that being on work's timeline and I'm back on my own timeline and determining the chapter beginning and ends based on important moments in my life. So at the end, the chapter dates are, you know, like October, it ends on October 28th, the day I quit my job, you know, November 16th, I think, or 18th, my last day of work. So I'm back on my own timeline. And once I had that structure, I knew what I was writing toward, you know? And so when I wrote each of the chapters, I knew the moment that I wanted to get to at the end.
Interesting. Okay. So your boss, who you call Boone in this, it's not his real name, has the real Boone the billionaire, read this?
Right question. I don't actually know. I think that, you know, he knows about the book, but I have heard nothing from him or anyone on that side. So, you know, if he does, I can say that I hope he realizes that I still have so much respect for him, actually, even at the end. And I wanted to write about my experience as truthfully as possible and full of humanity for everyone. And, you know, it's very difficult for me to write about any character if I don't actually have some touch of affection for them. And I think I have affection for everybody in the book. Like, I understand.
Oh, well, yes, yeah, you respect him for sure. So the thing is, when you were writing stuff like this, what was the struggle, if any, of going, oh, am I telling too much of this? Because it is a rarefied world, you know,
it is
that
a rarefied
most of us
world. Yeah.
Most of us can't, don't have access to. So what was that like? And how did you make the decision of, do I include it or not?
I, from the very first draft, told myself that I'm centering it on my story. And more than that, it's not a tell-all about any one person or any firm or even any industry. It's my story, which of work, which happens to be set somewhere else. And so just that intention helped guide many writing decisions I had. And beyond that, not only did I tell myself it wasn't a tell-all, the term that I used was tell minimum. At first I tried to write the book without Josh in it because I just didn't think he was important to my story. Then I really realized that the story I wanted to tell about myself, he was a pivotal character at certain moments. And so I included him, but I tried to include, a minimum amount of stories of his such that his character makes sense. But I'm not here to reveal any secrets about my ex or boss or anybody else, or even my parents for that matter, you know. And that's Valerie, that's such a great question, because at first I didn't want to include some of the more difficult parts of my relationship with my parents. And then I realized that the book actually didn't work because I couldn't explain why I was at the job I was at and why that job felt so much like home to me if I didn't actually get into what had happened. And so, you know, I do talk about some of my difficult experiences growing up, but I don't dwell on them because that's not the point. And I don't need multiple examples of them. You know, I just need enough to, because guess what? Readers are super smart. I think readers are super smart. And so I think they can tell if you're being authentic or if you're keeping something from them, you know. And I just wanted to be candid and honest, but at the same time, I am writing my story. So I'm not writing anyone else's story. I take it as a great responsibility that I am writing a memoir with living characters now. And so I want to treat them with as much sensitivity as possible while still telling the truth, because I actually think our imperfections as humans make us beautiful, you know. And
I think
so
that's,
I hope, yeah,
so interesting. Yeah, definitely. It's so interesting that you said it's not a tell-all, it's a tell-minimal, because you're right, now that I think about it. When you're only including the things that are relevant to your journey. You're not actually bitching about Josh. You're not actually
exactly.
bitching.
Yeah.
You're not actually, I'm sure there's so much more that you could have told us about your relationship. But you are only including the stuff that is relevant, because a lot of writers who are tackling memoir are afraid of that. They are afraid of, you know, what it is that they're going to put on the page. But I think you've really made that distinction really well with tell minimum. That's great. Okay, so when you go, you've finished, let's say you finish your manuscript, and then you hand it in. And what was the next period like? Was the feedback from the publisher, did they have you know, notes and suggestions? Were they big? Were they small? That sort of thing.
They did have notes, and my entire publishing team is super wonderful. And, you know, I have an MFA, so I'm sort of experienced in the workshop model and just receiving feedback, you know, and I also have my literary agent who is also super wonderful and has given me much feedback. And I love feedback. I take it and I think about it. And my approach to feedback is, so, I mean, I think about all the feedback. I ended up taking up, but I'll explain what I mean by taking in a second. I usually end up taking almost all of my editorial team, publishing team's feedback. And by taking, I mean, you know, someone is pointing out something that made them stop or pause or think, or, you know, something that may perhaps didn't work. My agent and editors and, you know, they are just so experienced. Like, perhaps maybe their suggestions for the solution may not, you know, fit along with what I'm envisioning, but nevertheless, every piece of feedback they're giving points to something that caused them to, I'll just say, that took them out of the book, right? I think if a book is well written, no matter what genre, and I love all genres. I have my favorite, but, you know, it should feel seamless. You know, you should feel so immersed that you just want to keep on reading or listening. And so anytime that the feedback was, you know, maybe pay a little more attention to something here that might not be working, I paid attention to all of it. And sometimes it didn't mean changing that thing right there. It might mean changing something in the previous chapter because that scene doesn't make sense because I hadn't set it up correctly previously, you know? And so I actually ended up having very little structural edits. I think it was pretty just set. And I think with my editor, it just started at kind of the line level and really, but what I had to focus on the most was the middle part, because the middle part is where I'm trying to really describe my changing mind, you know, and I'm trying to put it on the page. And in the beginning, I'm having this, like, the narrative is very much focused on, or certainly the prose and the text is very much about restraint. And then later the prose and text is more reflective and introspective, and just, it's about me, the character, breaking through. And so it's also more non-linear and experimental. And so just kind of getting that change correct from, you know, one thing to another was rather difficult, but it's what I spent the most time on.
So you've now written this fantastic memoir. What's next? What's the grandmaster plan? Because you're not in that high-paced, frenetic world where, you know, there's always something to do, always something going on. Not that you don't have anything to do now, of course. I mean, it's just not at the warp speed. So what's the plan?
I would love to continue writing books. I mean, I just absolutely love investigating periods of profound change, both within individuals and within society. I'm also, you know, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned, like, how did I get into, like, my love of literature and writing? And I remember my favorite books to check out when I was little were I checked out all books, but memoirs and autobiographies. But, you know, the first thing I did was actually I looked at in all books, business books too, I looked at the biographies of people. I'm just super interested in how we become who we are. What are the important moments and decisions in our lives that lead us to exactly where we are today? And how do we acquire the values we have and live the way we do? You know, and so I don't know specifically what the topic of my next book will be. I have many ideas, but I want to keep exploring my favorite topics in hopefully creative nonfiction, but maybe on the fiction side of that divide. Like, I don't know. I don't exactly know yet.
How exciting. So what does your day look like these days?
So right now I'm still I'm working on quite a few shorter pieces for various publications. And so it's a lot of I write first thing in the morning when my brain is like freshest. And I have to say, you know, not everyone does that, but that's the way I work best. And then after that, I usually, well, right now have either some, you know, interviews or some other things to get to. But because I didn't major in English for much of my just writing career, when I wanted to switch careers from finance into writing, I felt very behind. I felt very behind other people who had English degrees and had been in writing for a long time. So I told myself that, you know, there's this like 10,000 hours thing of like becoming good at something and mastering it. And I just did the math and said, if I worked 8 hours a day, 365 days a year, I could make that 10,000 hours in 3.5 years, which is what I did. So,
Oh
yeah.
my God. That is astounding. You are so systematic. Jeez. Okay, so let's end with, if you had to give your top three writing tips for writing memoir, right? For writing memoir, to aspiring, writers, to listeners who are thinking, oh, that might be something I'd want to do one day. What would your top three writing tips be?
I think the first is I had to really discover what kind of writer I am. And I read a lot of craft books, a lot of like how to be writer books. I think I love them. I read all of them. And my husband, he is also a writer of music. So not of words, but of music. And I mention him because he and I have totally different processes. And I say, as a writer, I think you just have to know what literal practice and process works for you. And I need complete silence. Often I close my shades so that I can like literally physically tune out the world and just imagine a world, imagine my past on the page. And one of my editors gave me this wonderful piece of advice before I started, to just, your number one job as a memoir writer is to protect your own memories. Because once you start thinking about what someone else might think, or what, you know, should I, like, is someone else going to feel bad about, you're allowing other voices to sort of influence the pure memory of yours that you're trying to first get on a page, right? That can come later. And so my first tip is just to know your own process. And you know, for example, my husband likes to, he likes to be on the internet when he writes. He's so productive when he's on the internet, also texting other people. And he's so productive that way. I cannot be, and I just need pure silence and to like tune out the world. The second tip is I end the day, and this was really just helpful for me. I end the day knowing what I want to tackle the next day, whether that be a memory or a character. And part of the reason for that is I think I'm allowing my subconscious to work overnight. So if I know what I'm working on, just underneath the surface, I'm like thinking about it, you know, the proverbial insight that comes to you in the shower, but also when you're sleeping, you know, when you wake, many times I wake up and I'll be like, oh, that was the solution to something that I was, you know, working on the night before. And then the third tip is, if so, two and three are going to sound similar, but they're very different. And the third tip is actually, so I just mentioned the 10,000 hours, I did 8 hours a day, 365 days a week for 3.5 years. A lot of it was sitting in front of my computer, staring at a blank page, writing. But a lot of that work was actually, I mean, my husband jokes with me that it's not really work, but it is work, because I'm training my subconscious to work. And so my third tip is just to immerse yourself in narrative. So for example, you know, I wrote this book, Private Equity, a memoir about a young woman's journey through in the finance world. I immerse myself in plays like the Lehman Trilogy, shows like Billions, Succession, also Mad Men, The Wire, even Emily in Paris, which has the same premise as me. 29-year-old Midwest woman goes to a big city, gets a job, you know? And I have had, The Handmaid's Tale. Yeah, I just immerse, when I was not at my desk, staring at a blank page and writing, I was otherwise immersed in narrative that helped me come up with so many solutions to problems that I was working on. It just naturally happened. And once I immersed myself enough, things just came to me, like solutions. And I couldn't believe it. And so, yeah, that's my third tip, just to immerse yourself in narrative that's like marginally related to what you're doing. And the corollary to that is trust the process. It works. Mm. Just trust it.
Let me just unpack. I have to go back to the 10,000 hours, 8 hours a day, 365 days a year for 3.5 years. A, did you actually do that? B, what did you do for those 8 hours?
Yeah. So
did you actually do it? 365
I would say I would say I did. Yeah. Can ask my you know, we'd be on Long Island during Christmas with my husband's family. He's Italian American, and he works that same way too. So we're like, during Christmas, we're available starting at like 4 p.m., you know? But yeah, so it is an intense process. But I will say I'm just so used to that now that like I automatically get in it and I feel creative because I think my brain is primed to be thinking that way for that time. And so
I guess it's fewer hours than you were working at the investment firm, right?
Yes. And the main difference is I have control over those hours, you know, whereas before, even if I had Saturday off, I might have to answer a text and then completely change my plans. But to your point, your question about how I spent those hours, I sit at my desk starting at 8 a.m. and I write until I can't anymore. Usually it's about like 1 or 2.
But what were you writing? What were you writing?
Your
pursuit of mastery.
Okay. Yes. During my MFA, it was a lot of essays. It was essays, and they ranged from more personal to more just strictly about work and a narrative critique of capitalism and, you know, just ideas. And they were not cohesive in any way. It was just very like collage-y. And I also wanted to give myself the freedom to discover what kind of writer I would be, because I had actually no idea what form felt natural and what voice felt natural. I experimented with some things that absolutely didn't work, or just that it didn't feel like it was the right approach for what I was doing, trying to do. And so, yes, I wrote a ton of those that, and they will never see the light of day, hopefully, because they're terrible. But it allowed me to get it into both an artistic practice and discover then my voice that is now in this book.
Brilliant. Your discipline is amazing. It's absolutely fantastic. I said that I was going to wrap up, but I have to ask this question because we've already spoken that you were well rewarded in terms of your remuneration, but there were just perks, right? Not only perks, just not only perks within the office itself, there were perks in, you know, being able to skip the queue at customs and immigration when flying internationally, but also the gifts. I mean, your boss obviously appreciated, you know, so on your birthdays, you got things like, here's $5,000 store credit at Barney's, or here's $3,000 to spend at this incredible, I don't know, top quality Pilates trainer or something like that. It was just constant, right? So I have to ask, after experiencing that world and the perks and the gifts, do you miss it? Or what do you miss about, do you miss anything about that time? That's the question, I guess.
On the perks, I don't miss it at all. I am just so happy with my computer and a blank page. I am really just the happiest there. And probably a couch. I like to lie down in the afternoon. I read on my phone. No, I don't miss the perks at all. What I miss about that time, maybe this, you know, I have to say that this sounds like such an easy, I miss the convenience of having good health care in America. That's really difficult for anyone freelance. I mean, not anyone creative because often they have jobs, but freelance, it's very, healthcare is a very important thing for people. And unfortunately in America, it's tied to the job. And so just to have that, and then as I describe in my book, I could easily get an appointment with any doctor, you know,
with anyone,
Yes. Yes. It literally anyone. And they're like, you know, doctors who operate on professional athletes, you know, within, you know, half a day. And so it's just that sort of convenience of life, you know, I do miss that, but I also realize that that's the inequality, really, that I'm trying to examine and analyze, because to have that privilege, you know, I had certainly traded a part of my soul, at least, for that. And I think if everyone does that, that leads to a fairly unequal society where, you know, people with means can really be healthier than other people. And so, yeah, I think what I miss is just kind of, it's definitely not the money or the perks, but just the convenience of having that kind of a life. But I wouldn't trade that for anything, because I feel more alive and more with more agency and freedom than I have ever had when I made a stable income.
Well, I, for one, am very glad you made the shift. Everyone, Carrie Sun's book, Private Equity, go get it. Thank you so much, Carrie, for all of your time today.
Thank you so much, Valerie, for having me. I loved our conversation.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Carrie Sun. Now, I want to leave you with this fun fact. You can tell a lot about a book by its cover, particularly from its smell. Book conservators use a historic book odor wheel, to determine when and where a book was published based on its smell. There is real science behind this. Books were made using different chemical compounds at different times, and so they really do have distinct smells based on when they were made. So, for example, books made before 1850 smell completely different to books made after that because of a process known as acid sizing used during the 20th century. The research was carried out by the Institute for Sustainable Heritage at University College London. So there you go, a historic book odour wheel. There's your fun fact for the week. Thanks so much for hanging out with me. Do connect with me on social media. Join the listener community on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community and request to join. You can also connect with me personally at Valerie Koo on Instagram and over at valeriekoo.com. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I look forward to chatting to you again next time. Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writercentre.com.au/podcast or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writercentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.